for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Authorities feared dozens could be dead after a huge explosion at a Texas fertilizer plant in Boston. Officials continue investigating deadly bombings on the day of the marathon. And the FBI arrested a Mississippi man suspected of sending letters laced with toxin to President Obama and others. Joining me to talk about the tragedies and the investigations, Michael Greenberger at the University of Maryland Center for Health and Homeland Security, Ron Fournier of National Journal Magazine, and Roger Cressy, a counterterrorism expert who served in the Clinton and Bush administrations. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for being here.
Good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
What a week it has been. Ron Fournier, do we know what caused the explosion at the fertilizer plant in that small town of West Texas?
No, we don't. What we do know is a town of about 2,800 people is devastated. We have homes that have been wiped from the face of the earth. We have 5 to 15 people dead. We have several dozen injured. And we have a crime scene. They're calling it a crime scene out of the abundance of caution. They have no reason to believe that it was done intentionally. Their suspicion is that it's an industrial accident, but because of the times we live in and because in any investigation, you prepare for the worst-case scenario, they're treating this as a crime scene and will rule out nefarious acts along the way.
The date in and of itself is relevant, Ron.
Certainly, it could be. It certainly is eerie. Tomorrow is the anniversary of the disaster at Waco, the Branch Davidian disaster. And obviously that has roots to anti-government feelings in this country. And when this happens at the same time, we have the bombing in Boston and Ricin attack coming out of the South, it makes people very concerned.
Roger Cressy, why are fertilizer plants so dangerous?
Well, Diane, the chemicals involved in creating what has been described by some as a dual-use product. I mean, it's used for obvious reasons in fertilizer for agriculture and a whole host of other things, but there is a explosive component and nature to it, particularly when gases are concentrated in an enclosed area. And what we've seen in the terrorism world is that fertilizer has been used in the past to help as an accelerant and as an explosive agent in terrorist attacks. So while this is certainly not that right now, there's real concern from a safety and security perspective. And I think what you'll see in the investigation, as Ron said, a criminal investigation is going to be part of this, is what were the safety and security precautions in place here? What was missed and why was this type of event allowed to take place?
And Michael Greenberger, how unusual is it that this should be called a crime scene, even in the face of any actual evidence to that effect?
Well, as was previously said, there's a lot of coincidences here. On top of the Waco siege, which was on April 20th, Timothy McVeigh, 2 years later on April 20th, using fertilizer as part of his explosive construction and later we find out his complaint was about the Waco siege. 2 years later, he blew up the Oklahoma City courthouse. Now, you know, again, this is all supposition. I'm sure it's got the FBI and ATF alerted, but there's a lot of what we hope are coincidences here that catch the eye. And besides this being a very explosive chemical component, it also has gases that are suffocating in nature.
Ammonia.
Yes, ammonia. So it's not just that there's been this explosion, which has been tragic, but one of the reasons they had a second tank that they were worried about that it would go off too. But also, if you're too close to this, you're going to have respiratory problems, and you may need a ventilator or some other breathing assistance. So it's very challenging. The other thing is, was said the other day when we talked about this, nitrate, the FBI has tripwires for nitrate, people who buy nitrate because of the Timothy McVeigh experience. Well, here, somebody may have eliminated the middleman and gone to the manufacturing plant. Again, it is all supposition, but I'm certain that the FBI and the ATF are going to look very carefully to see whether this was a terrible industrial accident or something worse.
Well, let me draw a historical parallel to industrial accidents. On April 16, 1947, the deadliest industrial accident in U.S. history took place in Texas City, not all that far from this incident. Ammonium nitrate exploded on a vessel. 581 people were killed in that industrial accident. So we don't know what this is, but we do have this weird confluence of events, both terrorism-related and pure accidents in mid-April.
But then the question becomes how unusual it is to have a fertilizer plant located so close to a school and houses. The Dallas media is reporting Texas regulators knew in 2006 the fertilizer facility had two 12,000-gallon tanks of anhydrous ammonia and was near a school and neighborhood. I mean, what sense does this make, Roger?
So what happens often in an investigation, even if it's not a crime scene, in the aftermath, people look at the circumstances and you say, wait a minute, where was the common sense here? We see all the time when people are looking to build nowadays hazardous facilities, and the first thing they do is they do an assessment of the security landscape. What are some of the vulnerable areas? What are some of the schools that could be impacted, et cetera? And they look at blast radius and things like that. I think this is a case where you saw something that was constructed and has been in place for some time, and there wasn't not a whole lot of thought given to the potential safety concerns here.
West Fertilizer Company of West Texas told Texas Commission on Environmental Quality permit reviewers that emissions from the tanks would not pose a danger. That assertion was based on expected routine emissions, not the possibility of a catastrophic failure.
Diane, that's also whenever a company does an analysis, they never do the analysis based on the worst case scenario.
Of course.
They always do it based on scenarios that fit within what they're trying to accomplish. And because the worst case always is something that they have no control over, and if they put that forward, they'll never get the approval of the permits and the licenses and community support to build any type of facility.
So that company was required to build a wall between the tanks and a public road to prevent vehicles from striking the tanks. So the company complied on December 12, 2006. The agency's executive director issued an operating permit for the tanks, which already existed. So, in other words, how much investigation and safety precautions are taken before such an accident can occur? Ron Fournier.
Unfortunately, we have found out time and time again in this country over the last 20 decades that action isn't taken until there's a catastrophe. We have labor laws in place and laws guiding workplace safety because of disasters and shirt factories in the early part of the 20th century in New York. So unfortunately, it takes oftentimes a lot of people dying before our institutions do their jobs.
Michael.
Yeah, the other thing is when the permits were being, were going through the bureaucratic process.
Excuse me, Michael, just to point out, several listeners have called to say the Oklahoma City bombing was April 19th and not 20th.
I'm sorry, that was my mistake. It was very close to Patriot's Day, which is April 20th. But the none of the citizens in the permit process complained about this, which if it were in the middle of Boston, that wouldn't have happened. I just want to say also that the placement of chemical plants in dangerous areas is not unusual. I think it was 2004, the Department of Homeland Security did an assessment of the 15 most catastrophic terror-related attacks. First was the use of a nuclear weapon. Secondly was explosions of chemical plants. And the example they used were chlorine plants in northern New Jersey, which if exploded would spread chlorine over a tri-state area affecting millions of citizens. You know, we have, as Ron said, we have known about this being a danger. There's been efforts made to improve the safety. It has been resisted by the plant owners. And so this is not something that just was going to happen in West Texas. We're exposed all over the country on this. Final thing I would say, in Boston, there is what is called a BSL-4 laboratory where scientists experiment on the most deadly pathogens. And there was a leak out of that BSL-4 laboratory that absolutely drove the citizens of Boston crazy.
Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland Carey School of Law. Short break. We'll be right back. Talking in our first segment about the Texas explosion in the small central Texas town of West. Ron Fournier, you said during the break, it takes deaths for something to happen. Well, talk just, about the example you used.
Just again, to go back to the parallel to an industrial accident, this tragedy in 1947 that cost the lives of 580 people when ammonia blew up, that led to the first class action lawsuit against the United States in our country's history.
And where was that?
That was in Texas City. And more than 8,000 people got money out of that lawsuit. 8,000 victims or people related to victims.
Would you expect that as a result of this explosion in West Texas, there will be a class action lawsuit?
Well, if the investigation concludes that there was negligence on the part of the company here, then you can just about be guaranteed of that.
What's negligence? How do we define negligence, Michael?
Well, if a reasonable standard of care was not used by the company in using this or manufacturing this very dangerous chemical-oriented explosive, if they didn't follow a standard of care that's expected, that would be...
But what about the location of the plant itself?
That would all be taken into account
as to
whether there was
so.
a, it was a standard of care that a reasonable person would use under the circumstances.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was just going to say the problem there, though, is the state regulators knew where the plant was, and there was some mitigating action taken. The people of the city obviously knew where the plant was. It took up a big part of the city. So I don't know if the location itself would be a problem for the owners if, again, we're assuming for the sake of argument this was an industrial accident, not a crime.
Yeah, I just...
But if they didn't take mitigating actions, that they were, like, the right kind of barriers or that kind of thing, that obviously could be
exactly. The state could have expected a standard of care, and when you look at it, it wasn't followed, and nobody expected them not to follow what the state permitting would have required.
I see. All right. There's another incident in the news that has contributed to unsettling people. Tell us about the letters believed to have been laced with toxin. Roger Cressy.
Well, Dan, what we know so far is that there has been an arrest, and the arrest is related to an individual who is believed to have sent at least two letters, one to Senator Roger Wicker from Mississippi, and the second to President Obama, laced with ricin, a deadly substance.
I thought there was a third, too. A member of Congress in Alabama.
Yes, and I think there is a safe bet to conclude there's probably additional ones this individual may have sent as well. The good news here, I think this is a good news story, is that since 9/11, we have put in place layers of defense, for lack of a better word, in dealing with mail delivery to the federal government. And what we're able to do here is to identify these substances very early on in the delivery process, so there's really no chance of these letters ever making it to their final destination.
And joining us by phone from New Orleans, bioterror expert Gary Cecchini of the RAND Corporation. Gary, good morning.
Good morning, Diane.
Tell us about ricin. Where does it come from, and just how dangerous is it?
Well, ricin is a toxin that's chemically extracted from castor beans, and castor beans grow on a plant that is fairly ubiquitous, grows in hot areas, particularly in the southwestern United States, but is also invasive. You can find it in New Jersey. Does not tolerate freeze well, so you don't find it much farther north than that. And basically, the castor bean itself is toxic. If you were to eat a castor bean without breaking the envelope of the bean, the seed itself, it would just go right through you. If you break the bean and you eat enough of them, it becomes toxic. It becomes a bioterrorism agent depending on how you extract the ricin from the beans. And there are several ways that we won't get into on this program about how you particularly do that. But it's fairly well published, and it's become kind of a cause célèbre, if you will, of some fairly wacko groups.
It clearly can be weaponized. But weren't we also looking at ricin as a way to combat certain cancers?
Absolutely, yes. The way the ricin toxin works is when it gets into the cells of your body, it prevents your body from producing the proteins that you need to live, which is exactly what cancer cells do. They produce proteins that aren't good for you, and so it has been investigated as a potential way to target cancer cells. I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
I was going to say, and I would point out that, you know, castor oil has been around for many, many years. People might remember, you know, children of the 40s and 50s taking a spoonful of castor oil to help their digestion, and in fact, it's been found in ancient Egyptian tombs.
So how easy is it for someone to get hold of and then weaponize ricin?
Well, it's rather easy to get hold of because it grows in low-lying areas that are well-drained and have a lot of heat. I mean, you can find those beans. Weaponizing it is a different issue, and there are different ways to do that to different levels of purity. The initial indications, and this is an ongoing investigation, so I don't have all the facts and don't want to speculate more, but my suspicion is that the preparation that was sent in these letters is probably pretty crude, as in just ground-up beans. I would also point out that it's not clear, I think, to most experts whether you can actually make somebody sick from putting ricin into a letter. It's most deadly if it's injected, and then second most deadly if it's ingested.
Now, how does ricin differ from anthrax, which we saw in the last round of these kinds of nefarious, poisonous letters being sent?
Well, I sometimes refer to ricin as the poor terrorist anthrax. The main difference is that anthrax is actually a microorganism, and it creates spores, so it's very resilient in the environment. And the people that were sickened by those letters were sickened because they ingested those spores, which then propagated, grew within their bodies, and killed them. Ricin is actually just a chemical, even though it comes from a biological source. It really is just a chemical, and it's also very sensitive to nature. So at temperatures above 80 degrees or so, it's what we call denatures. It is no longer as toxic as it would be. Same with sunlight and other things that can affect it. So this is, compared to anthrax, a very smaller threat.
So what you're saying about anthrax is that if you simply opened an envelope containing anthrax without touching it, that the spores themselves would somehow emerge from that envelope and could be ingested with just your breathing the air around that envelope, which is not the case with ricin.
That's true. And with anthrax, it depends on to what size the anthrax formulation has been milled, as they say, or ground up. So if it's very small, it's very easy to inhale. That's not really the case with ricin. It is possible to make a ricin dust, if you will. But inhalation is much less problematic than it is with anthrax.
Roger Cressy wants to add a point.
Well, Diane, to follow up on what Gary said, if you go back to the anthrax attacks in 2001, you had hundreds of staffers and members of Congress in the Hart office building who had to go on Cipro because of concern that the anthrax spores got into the air conditioning system and traveled throughout the building. So the ability of anthrax to attack a larger population is a much higher concern. And as Gary said, when I was doing counterterrorism in government, we didn't worry about ricin as a significant threat because of the reasons he just described.
Now, have the letters that came to the president, to the other members of Congress, been confirmed to contain ricin? We don't know, or do we, Gary?
It's my understanding that there has been an initial identification. It normally takes 24 to 48 hours to really confirm ricin, and I know they're doing that with my former colleagues up at Fort Detrick at this moment. Generally, the initial screening is very sensitive but not very specific, and so, you know, and particularly because this is an ongoing investigation, they just want to be as specific as they possibly can, and that may take another day or so to really nail that down.
And Gary, final question for you. I know you don't want to speculate, but could you see any connection between any of the incidents happening around the country, the Boston Marathon, the letters to the president, members of Congress, the explosion in Texas? Do you see any connection whatsoever?
I really don't, and it's a confluence of coincidence in many particular cases. I was listening to the conversation earlier. I would also point out to you that April 20th is Hitler's birthday. So, you know, if the conspiracy theorists really want to go crazy, they can add that into the mix. We don't know. It is interesting that these letters were mailed shortly after the Boston bombing, might have been mailed before then, but which is similar to what happened after the 9/11 attacks and then the anthrax letters came out. So there's a certain, what I would call, a coattail effect, where people think that, you know, now the public is shaken up, it's time to do my crazy attack. But I, you know, I'll leave that to the federal and local authorities to decide if these things are truly related, but I don't see any evidence that they are personally.
Ron Fournier.
I personally think there might be a tie to the fact that today's my mother's birthday, but that's just me.
Well, they...
No, seriously, I think to pick up on a phrase you just used, law enforcement officials do think this was a crazy attack, that this was a gentleman. They're identifying a guy named Paul Kevin Curtis, who, in according to their investigation so far, and of course we have to be careful about buying into the early part of an investigation, but this is someone who was known to authorities as a letter writer and a conspiracy theorist and thought that the government was taking part in a organ trafficking conspiracy. He wrote in the letter, in both letters, allegedly, "I'm KC, and I approve this message." So you have to wonder about the stability of a man who uses his own initials in the letter and a political ad slogan for his letter.
Ron Fournier, he's the editorial director of National Journal Magazine. And Gary Cecchini, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Diane.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We're going to open the phones now, 800-433-8850. And before we do, the President and First Lady have arrived in Boston to attend an interfaith service for the victims of the bombings. The service is set to begin at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Do we know anything more about those bombings in Boston? At camera at Lord and Taylor's in Boston, Michael, seems to have picked up something.
Yes, that's true. But I think if we've learned anything over the last 24 hours, it's not to draw conclusions too quickly. I am personally very satisfied with the nature of the investigation. I think there are others who have a high degree of confidence that ultimately they'll be able to pinpoint the perpetrators, but it may take a while. And I think everybody right now is best advised to leave the law enforcement investigators to their job.
Ron Fournier, yesterday we had such confusion. Various networks, various news organizations reporting a suspect had been arrested and then withdrawing that allegation. What was going on?
Well, without going too deeply into the new media model, we now have I'm an old wire service reporter, as you might know. You worked for the AP for years, and we were trained and were brought up in a culture of being right first and first second. And we were very fast, and we had to be. They still are. They're among the fastest, but they're trained to be careful as they're being fast. Now we have the democratization of media, where everyone is a journalist who has access to a computer. And it's really lowered the standards. And what you saw yesterday was a lot of folks who should know better or a lot of folks who don't know better reporting the first things they heard from people who have a badge. And the funny thing you learn when you do in this business long enough time, that even well-intentioned police officials often are passing on things they heard on CNN or things they heard in the break room or rumors that are going on in the police station. And you have to be very careful and vet and double check everything you report, even if you're hearing it from somebody with a highfalutin title. I know on 9/11, I was part of getting something wrong for the AP, and I was part of us getting a lot of things right. But I was part of and played a big role in a mistake we made that day. And I got that information. I can't say who the person is, but it was a very high-ranking person in the White House who had every reason to have the right information and who had never led me wrong. But in the cloud of war that day, gave me some information that was wrong, and I passed it on to the people. You have
Roger
to be really
Cressy.
Careful.
And for the record, I wasn't that individual.
No,
he's never helped me out, just for the record. He's never been a source.
So I've seen this from both sides. I've seen it from being inside the government, and I've also seen it in my work as a news analyst for NBC. And I think NBC, for example, did a great job yesterday. They were very reluctant not to hop on board once that initial report came out. The pressures on the media now to be first are so strong that, as Ron said, you see people make mistakes. And I think you also have to realize that a lot of the leaks that come out aren't from the primary source of information. It's from a secondary or a tertiary person who hears it from somebody else or reads it and then passes that on. And inevitably, something gets lost in translation sometimes. And in a fast-moving investigation like we're seeing up in Boston, we shouldn't be surprised by that. So remember the old adage from the Pentagon, the first report in war is often wrong.
Michael.
Yes, well, I agree with everything that's been said. But the other thing I want to say that I think is noteworthy is the FBI and ATF's and the Fusion Center's reluctance to try and their caution in identifying somebody. They've obviously made some really bad mistakes in the past. Richard Jewell in the Atlanta Olympic bombing in 1996. The anthrax investigation, they pinpointed a doctor at Fort Detrick, Stephen Hatful, and he ended up suing and winning money from the government because the investigation was so bad. They then pinpointed a man named Bruce Ivins who had committed suicide, and studies have shown that that conclusion was not good.
Short break. We'll be right back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at gatesfoundation.org. By the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at joycefdn.org. And by the John A. Hartford Foundation, working to improve the health of older Americans at jhartfound.org. This is NPR.
A musician travels the world to study the science of bug music, what we can learn from the sounds of crickets, cicadas, and beetles. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. It's time to open the phones as we talk about what has become one of the worst weeks in April of 2013 that certainly is going to go down in history as one of the worst in our country. Let's go to Ocean Springs, Mississippi. Stephen, you're on the air.
Thank you, Diane. I mean, first of all, I appreciate the great work you do and having intelligent and timely discussions and
Thank
events
you.
Like this. You're truly a national treasure and enjoy your show daily.
Thank you.
Something that I haven't seen pointed out in the media about this particular plant, and I've got some experience in it, they were going to put a plant to process some fish in a neighborhood next to a school probably about 8 years ago. And initially, the concern we had was the smell of the issue. And later on, we started to investigate it. They were going to be using several thousand pounds of anhydrous ammonia. And one of the problems that you have, particularly in the South, with this particular product is that, at least it was 8 years ago, it was the only component that is not readily available that's used for cold cooking of crystal meth. And there are problems, you know, literally almost weekly where they, because there's not a lot of sources that can get this ingredient, where people breaking in and stealing it. And of course, when they break in and steal the anhydrous ammonia, they typically don't take the time to close the tank back and do things like that. And the product itself is heavier in air and tends to stay close to the ground and is a tremendous health risk, particularly being next to an old folks' home, because it would cause evacuations. It could smother or kill people in it. I just don't understand how, even without the risk of the explosion, that it would ever be acceptable to have large components of this in Texas, which also has a crystal meth problem, like we do in Mississippi, where it's so commonly broken into and stolen because it's a component that they have to have.
And that's the question. Was the plant there first and the town built around it, or was the town there and the plant came in? I have an email here, two contradictory perspectives. The first, from Kirk in Florida, said the West fertilizer plant was infringed on by the growth of the city of West, not vice versa. On the other hand, Kate in North Carolina says the tragedy in West Texas underscores the benefits of and need for comprehensive land use planning and zoning. Ron.
Without speaking directly to this town, which we all don't know very much about yet, I can say generally, having lived for a short time in a town this size and having studied a lot about rural America and business regulations, that there is a cycle of acceptance in a lot of communities, cycle of dangerous acceptance. And it starts with the money that a plant like this brings in. And we can't ignore that. We can't ignore the fact that there's businessmen in that community who rely on that money, and regulators and politicians who are sensitive to that money and reliant in often cases on that money. And then the public in that town, which is reliant on the jobs that come from a business like that. So you have everyone who has incentive to put their hands over their eyes and over their ears and ignore the possibility and pray that something like this doesn't happen. And then when it does, they all point fingers at each other.
All right. To San Antonio, Texas. Good morning, Perry.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
My comment is about the gentleman who wrote the letters with the ricin in them. I have heard on the radio yesterday and today that the man who was arrested had written many letters to his congressman, and that was why he was a suspect. I also write letters to my congressman, as do others, and I think it should be clarified if he wrote threatening letters to his congressman or not. Otherwise, people might think if you write a letter to your congressman, you could be a suspect if something bad happened.
Perry, I'm so glad you called with that point. Writing letters to members of Congress is something we do in a democracy, and I hope you will continue. The concern here is what might have been in those letters. All right, let's go to Dallas, Texas. Good morning, Brian. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. My question and very quick comment was going to be about the fertilizer plant explosion. I think it should be clarified real quickly. The police, I actually work in TV news, I'm a producer. The police just wrapped up a press conference where they once again reemphasize they don't believe this has anything to do with terrorism. But we actually have seen, not just here in Dallas, but in Texas in general, a lot of these type of explosions. There was one a few months ago in a suburb of Dallas in Garland. A few years ago, there was one actually right next to downtown Dallas. There have been other ones near Houston. So my question is, a lot of these plants, especially ones near population centers, generally fail or do poorly when it comes to safety checks. Why don't local, state, federal bodies enforce the laws that are on the books right now, and that way we can avoid tragedies?
You know, Brian, I was in Dallas shortly after that explosion, so I do recall it, and I do recall looking out of one building at the remains of that other building in which the explosion had taken place. So the question becomes, why aren't federal officials taking more care about the placement of these plants?
Well, first of all, I think Ron's assessment of the small town environment is absolutely right, and it's a terrific point. But I will tell you, when I was in the Justice Department pre-9/11 worrying about these things, we had had the Bhopal incident in India. That had a very big effect on the regulatory environment here. But there is hand-to-hand combat between the people who own these plants. And as I said, there are terribly dangerous plants in New Jersey, northern New Jersey as well. Now, it's almost irrelevant to some extent whether this was an industrial accident or terror, because when it gets released, people are hurt very badly, and the resources of the communities are destroyed or stretched to their limit. So the question is, are we being careful enough in, for example, chlorine plants in northern New Jersey? The public really, I mean, we've said here, one of the silver linings here is it draws attention to the problem. But on a day-to-day basis in northern New Jersey, people drive by these things and don't understand. As I said earlier, the Department of Homeland Security in 2004 listed the explosions of these plants as the second most dangerous thing that can happen. Now, it's true they were looking at terror attacks, but if this is an industrial accident, it could happen in a high populated area, and there is not enough attention being paid.
All right, to Petra, New York. Hi, Holly.
Hi, Diane. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you.
Diane, I'd like to pose a thoughtful subliminal supposition. I called and spoke with a tip line yesterday. I said this: where was the placement of the first bomb by the flags that I saw the police tearing them down? And in other words, the placement of the first bomb, what flag was it placed by, be it a love or hate relationship with the bomber and the country of the flag? That's number one. And number two, I think they're going after international, because why is the video of the person placing the second bomb by Lord and Taylor, if you will?
Roger Cressy.
So it's an interesting concept. Is there symbolism in the attack here based on that? The bottom line is that the law enforcement community has made some significant progress. And I believe we'll see pictures of the suspect or suspects, because there are at least two. So we know this wasn't a traditional lone wolf attack. There is a broader...
We know that.
Well, if they're looking for two suspects, then that's not... It's a broader conspiracy.
That's what they've said.
That's what we're hearing. So if that's the case, then immediately they're going to be able to look through cell phone records. They're going to be able to go identify this individual and move quickly. And we're going to paint... A picture is going to be painted very quickly of whether it was just one, two, or more. And what is encouraging here is that the speed and skill of the law enforcement community on this is incredibly impressive. And that's not to say we're going to catch anybody real fast. It just means we're going to be able to identify the individuals extremely quickly.
All right. And what could authorities learn, Roger, from these pressure cooker pieces they found?
Well, they're doing a tremendous amount of forensics analysis right now. They're rebuilding the devices at the FBI facility in Quantico. But a pressure cooker device has been used for years as a tool of terrorism. It's been used internationally. It's been used in India, in Iraq, Afghanistan. This is a poor man's tool.
And yet you tend to think, apparently, that this was not connected to international groups.
That's where my gut leans right now. But I mean, as someone from Massachusetts who's run the Boston Marathon, who has looked at threat environments in my prior life, the idea of attacking the marathon, the iconic symbolism of that is a subculture. It's runners and it's New England. What is the broader international theme there? Now, yes, there are over 59 nations that participate. So there are things here that just don't add up in the traditional way that we've looked at international terrorism. But ultimately, Diane, we're going to have to see where the investigation goes.
And then there was a bomb scare at a Boston courthouse.
Well, that was all the result of the reporting there was a report that the suspect who was captured or under arrest was going to be taken to the Boston courthouse, or people were anticipating it. So there was a massive crowd around the courthouse, and the next thing you knew, you had a bomb scare in the courthouse, which I think goes to the question of we shouldn't get ahead of the story. I think one other thing people are worried about is what lies in the future, for example, like marathons. And I found it very instructive that the police commissioner of New York, Ray Kelly, and New York is considered first among equals, state-of-the-art counterterrorism measures. And he has said there's lessons learned here, and they're planning for the New York. They're not going to stop the New York Marathon, but their planning is going to be changed. They'll be doing different things. Again, we've said this earlier in the week. The law enforcement counterterror has been terrific. Some of it's been luck, but some of it's been very hard work. We have not had this rash of problems. Now we've had it. People are saying, well, maybe we better do things. And New York City has articulated what they're going to do to be safer. And look, that's the way things work. The Boston City Police are great, but everybody's learned lessons for how to deal with large public crowds.
Roger.
So we need to be clear on one point, which is you cannot guarantee 100% security on a marathon route. It will never happen. What you can do is you can improve security. You can minimize the risk. And this is all about managing risk, Diane, when it comes to securing these type of events. At the starting line, at the finish line, security can, in theory, be the greatest. But what if this bomb was planted at Cleveland Circle, at Coolidge Corner, at Wellesley? There are places there where you could have had a significantly higher casualty rate because the first responders wouldn't have been right next to it. So we'll be able to do things to improve the overall security. But there are always limits.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show to Winston-Salem, North Carolina. Good morning, Ryan. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
To speak to the general theme of your show, this kind of the worst week in history, as my birthday falls tomorrow, I kind of see this as sort of a repeat of some of the themes you were talking about earlier, like Waco. But we also have Columbine. We have Lincoln's assassination. We have the start of the Civil War. We have the Revolutionary War.
Of course.
I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I did want to speak to the general need for it, that it seems humans have to look for a meaning, to look for a connection. I kind of agree with your guess. I think a lot of this is just coincidence, but maybe we can talk a little bit about what is this need for us to find a connection and why is it important?
Well, first of all, I think one of the great silver linings, certainly out of the Boston Marathon situation, as was true after 9/11, is the coalition of people all over the country. And it's been talked about at sporting events. The New York Yankees played Sweet Caroline, which is the Boston Red Sox song that they play. But that's just an example. There's been a broader, I think, bringing together of people. This is not a partisan thing. And people are – so I think when we're searching for meaning, I'm very impressed by the fact that we are resilient and people – marathons are not going to be ended and we'll go forward. But – you know, it's one thing to talk about Hitler's birthday or Lincoln's assassination, but to my mind, just like I don't want to draw conclusions about what exactly happened, I think the reason this is a crime scene and the FBI is involved is they can't disregard the fact of some of these anti-government episodes.
Roger.
Well, Diane, we look for meaning because we want to try and understand. Right. Whenever innocents are killed and maimed, we have difficulty comprehending it. Why would people do it? And in any counterterrorism investigation, it focuses on three questions: who, why, and how. So we know the how now. We're getting close to the who. The why is going to be the one that always generates the most discussion and conversation. And sometimes that's the most difficult one to get our arms around. And, you know, we often talk about resiliency. And what you're seeing in Boston, what you're seeing elsewhere is a spirit of resiliency. And that, more than anything else, is what you take comfort in as a nation.
There's also a great period, a great sense of anxiety. And you just can't underestimate how it makes people feel to see a soft target like this hit. And with the lack, the reason we want answers, you're exactly right, is think about 9/11. Go back to how we were feeling then. And if we didn't know who did it, what if we went for 6 months and we didn't know the who or the why? The fact of the matter is what helped get us through that period and what gave us some resilience was right away we knew who the bad guy was, and the President of the United States unleashed the, you know, hell on Afghanistan. And we all felt better in a way. Because at least we were doing something. And right now, we're in this period where we don't know what to do.
However, let us not forget the negative effects of the aftermath going into Iraq when there were no weapons of mass destruction. Ron Fournier of National Journal Magazine, Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, and Roger Cressy, former counterterrorism official in the Clinton and Bush administrations. Thank you all so much.
Thank you,
Diane.
And thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in